Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. This week we're talking to Inigo Canalejo, who is the Vice President of ESG at IFCO. So why focus on ESG? Why have a whole episode on this subject? The environment, social and governance function is one of the hottest positions in any company. If you're selling IoT or designing IoT solutions, you really need to be thinking about the impact of sustainability on the opportunities that face you. As we bring digital and physical convergence together, then our ability to understand what's happening in an enterprise and give data to this function, which is, in this case, reporting directly to the CEO, in other cases, to the CFO, It's a very important part of any entrepreneur's calculus as they map out the opportunities, they think about their sales strategies. So I think you'll enjoy the conversation with Inigo. I certainly did. He's a really smart, globe-trotting guy, and a lot to learn from here. And I hope you enjoyed as much as I did.
The Mr. Beacon podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, intelligence for everyday things, powered by IoT Pixels.
So, Inigo, thanks so much for joining us on the Mr. Beacon podcast.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you head up ESG at IFCO, and ESG is gone from being kind of an artifact, a sideline of a business, and it's become a central driver, and super important. This podcast is, we're focused on arming entrepreneurs, solution designers, and I personally believe that we need to design with sustainability in mind. So I thought you would be a great person to have on to explain what ESG is, what the implications are, and what the opportunities and the threats are if people don't think about it. So thanks for coming on the show to talk about all of that.
My pleasure. So yeah, a lot of people ask me actually, what does ESG actually mean? So environmental, social, and governance. And and again, what's the difference with other previous topics or words that were used probably for similar purposes like CSR initially, and of course sustainability as well. No? For me, it's they all sort of mean the same in reality. Maybe ESG is a bit broader, which I think is good because at the end, what this is looking at business and what we do from a different lens, right? So a very, let's say, wide lens, looking at it from an environmental point of view. A lot of people associate sustainability only with the environmental piece. But of course, there is the social piece, the part of the supply chain, the part around health and safety, the part around diversity. There are so many, let's say, areas that are part of what we do that wouldn't be, let's say, part of the definition of sustainability, let's say the environmental piece. So it's definitely a broader term. And of course, the governance, which is around, okay, how are you running your business now? And all of the, let's say, structures, but also I would say all of the ethics behind what you're doing. So to me, what's great about ESG and why it is so important for businesses nowadays is that, again, no, the concept of the triple bottom line is you can no longer evaluate a company just by its returns to investors. You need to look at, say, the whole broad picture of what it's doing for the environment, what it's doing for society, what it's doing for its employees and its communities. No? And that's the beauty of it, because we're basically, companies are sort of questioning what they do, you know, within, let's say, the purpose and what the ultimate goal of the business is, but most importantly, how they do it. And I think that's the really interesting part, because, you know, the people that work at ESG, like ourselves, basically we have an opportunity to influence how we do things almost in, you know, every single thing that the company does. No, it touches so many different elements. It touches everything that the company is involved in, and therefore, it's really inspiring to be able to influence that as well. And
very good.
And when we talk about threats and opportunities, look, every company has its own threats and opportunities related to ESG. Of course, it very much depends on the industry that you're in and the type of business that you have. But overall, the way I see it is mainly opportunities. Of course, you know, for us, we're blessed because of what we do. We work in reusable packaging. We are certainly a pioneer in the concept of the circular economy. IFCO started 30 years ago sharing and reusing packaging, applying the principles of the circular economy when almost nobody knew what the circular economy was, right? So we are fortunate to have a business model that is actually intrinsically sustainable. And as one of my previous jobs managers always said, we wake up in the morning and we work for a sustainable company, right? So that's fantastic. But of course, you know that you can do a lot more, right? So there are tons of opportunities to actually run your business in a more efficient way. And the part that I love about these opportunities is that it goes hand in hand with what we do, right? So trying to make our business better for the environment, better for our employees, better for our partners and the communities also brings opportunities to reduce costs, to optimize our processes, which is, of course, you know, what we have been focusing on for years and years as well. So there isn't a real conflict between, for us, you know, what we want to do at ESG and how we want to drive the business. And that's why it's so important that sustainability and ESG is integrated into the strategy. You know, the more we do to do better as a business from a financial point of view, the more sustainable we're going to be. And the same way, you know, the more sustainable we want to be, actually, the better our business will be, the better our returns.
So you've touched on a lot of things I want to drill down in, but I also have to confess to an ulterior motive. Wiliot's a much smaller company than IFCO, and we're relatively young, but we decided, you know, we believe our business can also help make supply chains more sustainable, maybe in a slightly different way, but very related to I think, what you guys do as well. So we decided we got to walk the talk. So we're looking for, I'm hoping some young, enterprising ESG professional will be tuning in to hear what you have to say, and we'll be interested in joining Wiliot because we're looking to hire our very first kind of sustainability ESG person. So I'm just going to put that out there. It's very self-serving, but my job is to hire that person. So not actually why I invited you onto this podcast, but it certainly is a coincidence that I'm very happy about. Having got that little advert out of the way, I think we should spell out for people that are not familiar with IFCO, just in a little bit more detail, you know, what is it that you guys do?
Certainly. So we are quite a unique business. As I mentioned, we operate in the circular economy. And when people ask me, you know, what does your business do? I say, well, we provide packaging as a service. That's exactly what we do. And the way that I explain our business is we don't produce anything. Right? We don't manufacture anything, and we don't sell anything either. And then most people say, well, then what do you do? You know, what is it that you actually we provide packaging as a service. So we rent packaging. So our customers share and reuse our packaging in the supply chain. So we work mainly in the fresh produce supply chain. So the growers of potatoes, cucumbers, and tomatoes rent our crates, reusable packaging crates, RPCs, we call them. They fill them with their goods. They send them to a retailer, their customer, The retailer uses those crates to put them on display at the supermarket. So I'm sure many of our listeners would have been some of our crates at the supermarkets. And then once they're empty, we collect them, we fold them, which is really important because you optimize your logistics flow, your reverse logistics flows. We send them to what we call our service centers, where we inspect the crates, we repair them if they need to be repaired, we wash them, we sanitize them, and then we issue them back to the next user. So, and then that's when they start, you know, the next cycle. So it's all around our customers and the supply chain sharing and reusing our packaging in their supply chain.
And so what are the core competencies that you need to operate that? You don't actually manufacture the crates that you're pooling, do you, or do you?
We don't. No, we don't. As I said, we don't produce anything.
So you design them, you specify them. We decide what the crates need.
Correct. Okay. And again, no, we've been doing that for many years now, so we have a lot of expertise in the design, optimal design. There's a big element now around automation, for example, at the warehouses, and therefore the design of the crate is more important than ever because of that. And there are a lot of advantages from an operational point of view versus single-use packaging around the capacity of automation as well. So we design them, we don't produce them, and the core competence for us, again, is having that network and operating this in an efficient way. It ends up being quite complex because of the size of the business that we have. So we own over 370 million of these RPCs, and we operate a pool of these RPCs at a global scale. So we operate in Europe, we operate in America, in Latin, North America, Latin America, in Asia as well. So imagine the toughest thing is actually to have all of these crates, let's say, like under control, making sure that we know where they are, that we can deliver them. They need to be at the right place at the right time. And of course, getting them back, sanitizing them and issue them again. No? So the essence of our business is around keeping this packaging in circulation as much as possible. And to me, I think that's probably the toughest part.
And so is your competition the cardboard box, the single-use cardboard box? Or?
Mainly, yes, mainly. So the most, let's say, implemented solution in the market is single-use packaging, is cardboard. I mean, there are other, you know, solutions like single-use plastic as well, but let's say the majority is a cardboard box. And then there are obviously other peers that do a similar operation like IFCO does around reusable packaging, but there aren't any that do it in a such a global, large scale, let's say.
So you're kind of a giant in this particular segment of the market.
I would say so. I think we are the industry leader.
And where is the world in terms of progressing to reusable packaging in your segment? What's the proportion of people that use this circular approach versus just binning the stuff after they've used it?
There's many different, I mean, you asked me about the world, right? And that's a tough one because depending on where you are in the world, okay. It's actually very different, right? Yeah. So I would say, for example, in Europe for fresh produce is quite implemented, let's say. So the penetration of reusable packaging in fresh produce is quite large. In other regions, maybe in North America, for example, even now, where you would think, I mean, one of the key, let's say, facilitators of what we do is a modern supply chain. Of course, you need a supply chain that has distribution centers, that has automation, that has reverse logistics in place, right? And that's where, you know, solutions like ours, a standard solution, actually make a real difference. If you go to other regions where are not so developed, like, for example, India, then it's very difficult to implement a solution like ours. But again, going back to my point around the North America, even in North America, where, you know, you have a very modern supply chain, of course, the penetration is not as large. And I have to say, you know, a big reason for that is that, you know, cardboard has been the standard solution for many, many years, right? And whereas in Europe, again, we've been working on replacing single-use packaging for the last 30 years, and it's well implemented. Over there, it's still new, and I have a lot of conversations with, you know, potential customers or customers that still have some produce in packaging, understanding the benefits also from a sustainability point of view, because, you know, to be honest, I mean, we started actually with a big sustainability background because it was at the time when Germany had a legislation around waste And actually, you know, our founders thought, okay, well, if there is a focus on reducing waste, then the best way to do that is actually not to generate any waste in the first place. So why don't we reuse these, yes, these crates? And they invented this model. You know? So there's a lot of debate around that. And there's still a lot of people that don't understand, let's say, the differences or the improvements or the benefits of reusable packaging. And they never looked at it from a sustainability point of view. So in the past, it was all around efficiencies, no? Where finding efficiencies from an operational point of view. But of course, there are huge benefits of reusing packaging versus generating all that waste in the first place.
So would you say that in terms of just at a very crude level, Europe versus US is the majority of packaging reusable in Europe, or has it got to that point yet?
Well, this is the thing. It depends on the category, right? So for fruit and vegetable in, let's say, large retail chains, yes. I would say the majority of packaging is reusable. Now, of course, if you look at other categories, if you look, of course, to durable goods, the majority of packaging is single use, whether it's single use plastic or whether it's single use cardboard, right? But within fresh produce, I would say, yes, there is a high penetration rate.
And sounds like we can't say that for the US market for fresh produce. It's,
not as much. I think, and it's growing very, very fast. And we are growing as a business as well there, because again, now the environmental sustainability element is becoming more and more relevant. So there are a lot of opportunities there, and there's a lot happening, let's say. But, you know, if we take a picture today, the penetration is not as high in the US, but I'm sure it will be very soon, because there is a lot of inertia in this move.
And, we're an IoT podcast. So it's, you know, one of the reasons that I'm fascinated by this adoption is, you know, it's sustainability as a driver. There's also other drivers, but it means that we can actually start to apply IoT more to these packaging systems. It's hard to justify putting a Bluetooth sensor on a cardboard box, but you can justify it on a plastic crate. Where would you say we are with the adoption of IoT in reusable packaging for produce? You know, my sense is we're still early on in the market. It's got a lot of potential.
I agree. That's what I would say. I think, again, the potential is huge, as you said. In a single-use packaging, it doesn't make a lot of sense, especially because of the cost. But, you know, everything we do is around product life extension. So we design our products so that they can last for a very long time, right? As long as possible. So therefore, if you have a device that, maybe you need to invest a bit, but, you know, it's for a product that is going to last a very long time, then obviously the cost equation becomes much better. I think we're still early on, but at IFCO, we have a very strong program on digitalization of our business and of our asset base as well. And we really think there is a big opportunity for us to benefit from this. And I see three main advantages of IoT for what we do. No? The first one is around making things easier for our customers. No? So the ease of doing business, as we call it. Our customers currently declare where they're sending their packaging to, so that we know we need to go and collect it there, and we have our packaging under control. You know, in the future, if you think about, you know, packaging with sensors, there wouldn't be any sort of declarations, right? Everything would happen automatically. So therefore, it would make their life easier as well. Actually, much closer to what single-use packaging is, right? It's basically like a hassle-free service. You don't need to worry about it. Just use it, and then everything else happens, let's say, on its own. So that's one big advantage. The second advantage is for us as a business, again, going back to the point that I made around, we're doing things to make our business better, and therefore we're also making it more sustainable. So having more visibility of our assets in our supply chain will mean that we can operate our business in a more efficient way. And that means we can reduce cycle times, for example. So we will, sweat our assets more. We can use them more times, and therefore that's more sustainable. You need less packaging for that. Of course, you can lose less as well, because you know where they are, so you can go and pick them up, etc. So it will improve our operation, but also it will help us in our own sustainability objectives as well, in making our business more sustainable. And then the third, let's say, advantage that I see is, you know, additional services. I mean, in the same way that that visibility in the supply chain helps us operate our business better, more efficiently, it will also help our customers operate their business better. They will have visibility of their supply chain, both growers and retailers. You will have things like, of course, controlling damage, temperature. I mean, you know, we work with fresh produce. So let's say supply chain tracking and traceability in the supply chain is super, super critical and important, more so if you think about topics like food waste. And therefore, you know, any opportunity that we have to provide that visibility to our customers, I think will be very well received and would be an additional, let's say, benefit of using reusable packaging and working with IPCO.
I think this is a huge opportunity. So we're kind of, on one hand, we can optimize the operations of the pallet pool. We can lose less crates. We can run with a smaller pallet pool. But the real opportunity, it seems to me, is optimizing what's in the crates. And here, you know, we're just starting to see the opportunity because, of course, until you can measure it, you don't really know how big the problem is. And then you suddenly see... oh my goodness! This is not a a 3-day supply chain from the farm to the store. It's actually a 6-day supply chain. And if you can, you know, every day you can, as you start to see where the crates are, you can solve those problems and save a day. And that's another day of shelf life, another day in the refrigerator, a better quality product, less waste. So I think there's a huge opportunity. So let's go back to ESG itself, though. So what does someone in your role do? You know, you arrive at, you know, in the second half of this show, we're going to talk a bit about how you got this job. And but, you know, you arrive day one at IFCO. What do you do to set up an ESG function? Because I think there's going to be you know, trying to hire someone for ESG. My sense is this is one of the most in-demand job descriptions out there. And so there's going to be a lot of people who maybe they'll listen to this podcast. You know, what do I do? What's my agenda for my first 90 days? What was your agenda? What did you do?
Yeah. Look, I think that the first thing is understanding the business. And in fact, you know, I'm a good example of that because, you know, my background is in engineering, but I don't have an environmental, let's say, sort of background from studies, but I knew the business really well, right? And I did it at my previous job and also here at IFCO. I knew the business quite well, and I think that's the first most important thing, to be honest, because again, as I think, you know, every ESG program is going to be different at each company, right? You need to focus on the topics that are material for that company, and there's something called materiality, which is very common for us that work at ESG, which is understanding, you know, what do I focus on? Because, you know, everybody talks about, for example, carbon emissions. And yes, carbon emissions are let's say, across the board important, but, you know, they're going to be more relevant for one type of industry than they are for others, right? So it's really important to know your business and know what you do so that you can decide which are the material topics that you need to focus on, right? And what is your business all about? So for us, you know, one of the things that I did when I joined is also shape our program very much in line with what we do as a business. So understanding, okay, what does IFCO do? What is our purpose? And therefore, let's have a program that reflects that. And of course, let's try to continue doing, let's say, that good that I mentioned. We are a sustainable business, but we can do better. So the let's say, you need to know the business really well so that you know where to focus on. So that's one benefit. But the other big benefit of knowing the business is that you need to work with people. And I think, again, depending on how your structure is set up with your ESG program, in our case, we have a very small ESG team that sets the guidance, the objectives and the strategy, let's say, and then works with the rest of the business to actually put that strategy in place, right? So you need to work with people every day. And look, for some of them, ESG or sustainability was already a priority, let's say, and it was already embedded in what they do. For others, it's not. So it's very much about, you know, influencing and working with people so that they put the same priority to the ESG topics as they would do with any other, let's say, business KPI. So it's a lot about, first of all, you know, setting the program and setting the direction, but most importantly, you know, getting people on board, working with all of the areas in the business so that that program can actually, let's say, happen, can actually be put in place.
So you're learning the business, building the relationships. Presumably, you're understanding the problems. You look for where, you know, where am I exposed as an organization, and you're trying to orchestrate visibility of that. And I'm assuming one of the tools you have is also one of your responsibilities, which is like reporting, right? I'm assuming that's a big part of what you have to do. And it's those metrics that, you know, unless you measure it, things probably aren't going to improve. So it's probably a good thing that you are measuring it. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Reporting is an interesting one, right? Because it's sort of like something you have to do, but it's not the most exciting thing. And usually, as you say, no, it's where you start. I mean, you need to measure everything to make sure that you can actually understand what is happening, therefore influence it and improve it. The challenge with reporting is that in complex organizations like ours, who operate across, you know, many different countries with many different businesses, let's say, the level of reporting or the level of integration sometimes is not where it needs to be. So you need to work hard in trying to set that up, in making sure that the quality of the data that you have is at a certain standard. And that means that you need to, you know, work with the people in getting it done. So, and it's usually, you know, the kind of thing that people don't like too much, to be honest. So therefore, you know, you need to manage that in a proper way as well, because, you know, you don't want to be the reporting people, right? You need to be inspiring. I think, you know, a big responsibility that we have at the ESG team is to be inspiring. I mean, a lot of people join our company because we are a sustainable business, right? So we want to make sure that they live that is part of our culture. It cannot be part of reporting. I mean, reporting is the necessary devil, and you need it as well, of course, to improve your business, but it cannot all be about reporting.
Right. So it's about being authentic. We say we're sustainable, but let's really walk the talk. And I think you're right. This, your function can be a real asset for bringing some of the most smartest people into your company. If you're doing a good job, people will really want to be part of that. Certainly the people that commit their lives to their business. For me, work is more than just a way of earning money. It's and if you're in that class of person, then you want to be doing something that makes the world a better place. So you can be part of that, I'm sure. So how do you get people to change what they do? So you lift up the lid and you see, this is not good. How do you get people to change what they do?
To me, it's all about the win-win. Right. So and again, we are fortunate because of what we do. And as I mentioned before, the vast majority of the initiatives that we drive or that we want the business to drive around ESG and achieving our goals are in line with the objectives of the business to actually do things better, to do them more efficiently, to reduce costs, to optimize throughput. They're very much aligned. So, you know, in most of the cases, people don't need to, you know, completely think outside of what they were doing already. It's about doing more of what they're doing or looking at things in a slightly different way. So the win-win is critical, right? There needs to be opportunities for them to improve in their own, let's say, KPIs, in their own priorities, but also contributing to the ESG program. And as I mentioned, I think in our company, we're fortunate because that happens almost, you know, on its own, let's say. So and I'll give you an example. Now, obviously, part of our footprint is around transport, right? We move crates around. We actually turn our crates. Last year, we turned them 2 billion times, right? So these are crates moving around, let's say, the supply chain in trucks in most cases, but we also do a rail and boat to actually reduce the emissions. And therefore, that's a big source of emissions. Now, of course, it's a big source of cost as well, right? So if you look at your network, if you look at the type of vehicles that you're using, if you look at things like your fill rate at the truck, you're trying to optimize your cost, right? So you're going to do less kilometers, for example, optimize your route, and therefore you're going to be able to reduce your cost. And guess what? You're also going to reduce your CO2 emissions. So for the most part, there are initiatives that are directed towards doing that, right? Towards improving our business from a cost point of view, but also from a sustainability point of view. So there's not a lot of convincing that needs to happen because, you know, it's part of what they're here to do as well. And that's one element. And then the other element is that, again, it's in the culture, no? So, you know, probably 10 years ago, it was a lot of convincing that, look, this is the right thing to do, reducing emissions or reducing waste, etc. Now everybody knows that. Everybody understands that and they know that they have to do it, right? That is part of what we do. Just as, you know, everybody understands that we need to reduce cost and optimize our processes. So I think it's very much part of our culture. Maybe there are other companies that are more old fashioned where they still don't have that culture and maybe it's a bit more of convincing. But at a company like IFCO, with what we do and let's say the essence of our business model, I think that's very much understood. And there is a passion. There is also a lot of drive to further drive sustainability in the business.
And would you say carbon is a proxy for cost? Are the two can you know, when we're trying to drive down the carbon footprint, are we essentially driving cost out of the business?
For the most part, yes. I mean, again, it depends on what you do. But I'll give you two examples. You know. Transport is one, right? So if you're able to reduce your distances, then you can reduce your cost. So, and you can reduce your CO2 emissions. So in that case, yes. If we think about plastic, for example, one of the ways to reduce the carbon footprint of plastic is to use recycled plastic instead of virgin plastic. And okay, it depends on the market and the time, but recycled plastic can be cheaper than virgin plastic. So therefore it will reduce cost. There are other elements where, for example, you think about offsetting your emissions, right? Offsetting your residual emissions, where you need to invest in carbon credits. Well, obviously that comes at a cost. So in that case, you know, that formula wouldn't work. But for the most part, I would think so. And I can tell you again, no, another element is for us heating the water that we use to wash the crates. And that obviously consumes energy, let's say gas, for example. In some cases, well, you know, the less energy that we use to wash the crates and to make the process more efficient, then we reduce our cost, but we also reduce our carbon emission.
And to change tack, but it is actually related. Where do you report to? Who's your boss? Where does ESG fit in the corporate structure?
Yeah. But I think in our case, that was very clear from the beginning. I report to the CEO. And of course, it's not by coincidence. No, this is a super important topic for the company, for us, because, you know, it touches, again, all of our business, but it touches all of our stakeholders as well. It touches, you know, our customers, of course, our employees, but also even our investors, right? So I report directly to the CEO because of where ESG needs to be at IFCO. And also, I think from my boss's own perception of where ESG needs to be as well. So he's a true advocate of this. He's the first one that is very ambitious, actually, about what we should do and how IFCO should lead the industry in sustainability and ESG. And therefore, that's why, you know, he wants to make sure that he has, you know, let's say, direct overseeing and visibility of what is happening at the ESG program directly from the leadership team.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, Inigo, I'd love to hear a bit about your career. I was spying on you on LinkedIn, and it seems like you've done a fair bit of time in academia. Where did you do all your degrees? And it seems like it was you've been around the world a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. So I'm Spanish, based in Spain. I grew up in Spain, actually. But I spent my last year of high school in the States to learn English, to spend a year there and learn English abroad.
Whereabouts were you in high school?
In Long Island, in New York.
Okay, great.
At a boarding school in a very small town called St. James, a school called Knox. So that was a very different experience for me. A small boarding school, very traditional. And as I was growing up in Spain, you know, when you're 15, 16 years old in Spain, the world starts to open. You start going out, spending time with friends, etc. So this was a bit different for me because basically at a boarding school, you know, you're in school all day.
Well, it must have been a huge shock. The kind of the American culture and the Spanish culture are very different. And, you know, the age of majority over in the States, you know, it's effectively 21. And in Europe, you are already an adult when you were in high school.
That's exactly it. That's exactly how it felt back then. But look, it was a great experience. I mean, you know, you grow up, you're used to having sort of everything done for you and, you know, everything decided for you. And then you're there. And you need to really figure things out and adapt. And we had to, let's say, do a lot of stuff at school as well. So, one thing that I always talk about is, for example, ironing. No, I had to start ironing my clothes. And I remember I was used to, you know, somebody helping me out at home ironing my clothes. And the first day I got there, I said, okay, I'm going to do my laundry. I'm going to have to iron my clothes. And I ironed absolutely everything, no? So every piece of clothing I had, that was only my first time. Of course, the second time, you know, I only ironed whatever I had to iron, really. Everything else just went. But no, overall, really good experience, I would say. You know, you mature. That's the reality. You see life in a different way. It was tough sometimes because of those differences. But overall, when you look back, you see it as a great experience because you basically grow up and become, you know, the part of the person that you're going to be. So anyway, after I did that, you know, in senior year in high school in the States, you know how it is, you know, you're already applying to universities, doing your SATs. My initial plan was not to stay in the States. Actually, my initial plan was to come back to Spain and study. But as I got into that sort of, you know, environment of applications and interviews and you have a college advisor at school, etc., I thought, of course, with my parents as well, man, maybe it's not a bad idea for me to stay and study abroad, study here. So I applied to several different schools for engineering. I ended up going to Michigan, to the city of Flint, to a university called GMI, General Motors Institute at the time. It was called Kettering University. Which was a university founded by GM, actually.
I see. So I saw your early career was in the automobile industry. This is making sense now. Okay.
Of course. Yeah. It made all the sense. And my college advisor was a super fan of this school. It's a really good engineering school. It's a very small school. We were like 2,000 students. But it's very unique because basically every student has what they call a co-op sponsor. So students work and study at the same time. So half of the year you're in school and the other half of the year you're actually working from year one. So already, amazing. You know, I started my first job. I just turned 18 when I started working at an automotive factory, actually in Spain. So my co-op sponsor was General Motors Spain, opening Spain.
That is so good. I did something similar, not quite as extreme in England. I did a computer science thin sandwich course, and it was 1 year in academia, 6 months in industry, a year in academia, 6 months in industry, and then another year. And it was so good. It just, you grow up pretty fast.
Yeah. And it's really, I mean, it's so practical. Look, and again, now coming from the Spanish background where most of the careers are very theoretical. I had friends that I was studying, you know, engineering at the same time that I was, and there was so much theory for them compared to what I was doing. I mean, my school already, I remember when I visited the school for the first time, I was there with my parents while I was still in New York. And my dad, who is an engineer, we went around and they showed us the school and the facilities and the labs. And my dad loved the labs because he was saying, look, when I studied engineering, we had nothing like this, no? And in the States, of course, it was all about, you know, the labs, the practical application of the things that you're studying in class.
Oh, and again, I had a similar experience. I grew up in England, but I had a brief stint in an American school, and I remember just the difference, the resources, the amount of hands-on and practical yep. stuff. Because I went back to England, and they put me in the remedial class because we hadn't been doing the reading, writing, arithmetic type stuff. But anyway, yep. so I kind of, yours is more advanced, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah, so overall good experience. It was also tough because that meant that we were working for 3 months, then we studied for 3 months. So every 3 months I went back and forth to the States. And my job was actually, I already lived in Spain. I'm in Madrid. I'm from the north of Spain, from Pamplona. But I moved to Madrid when I was 8 with my family because of my dad's job. But my work with GM was actually in a city called Zaragoza, which is 3 hours away from Madrid. So I was already living abroad then as well. So it was tough because I was basically either studying or working, especially in the summertime, because all of my friends, of course, had long summers associated to university while I had to work. But look, overall, I thought it was a great experience. Of course, learned a lot, but it was funny. I remember the first day I went to work there, and I did like a rotational program, right? So every 3 months that I spent there, I was doing something different. The objective, I had like a mentor, Pedro, who's a fantastic person and basically took care of me and assigned me different assignments within the different departments throughout my 5 years of university plus my senior thesis. And my first assignment was in the communications department. And when I got there, look, I was 17 at the time. No, I just turned 18, but I looked like I was 14 probably. So I got there and I was wearing a tie. Of course, my mom said, "No, you need to wear a tie and a jacket." And I got to the communications department, HR department, and I introduced myself. And they thought I was somebody's son that was looking for his or father or mother. You know, what are you doing here? Like, no, I'm here to work. You know, so very, very, very interesting experience. And I really enjoyed it. I learned so much, you know, with so many different things. And of course, you know, people really took care of me and taught me. And I appreciate that even now, no? When I think about, you know, I have in my team, I have apprentices, I have working students. And I remember at the time, because when you spend different times with different people, you know, again, throughout the career, of course, you're going to find people that are more devoted to this, that really believe in, you know, young, let's say, professionals that are starting their careers yeah. and how important that time is for you. And others that maybe either don't have the time or don't have the interest. No, so yeah. I always thought when it would be my turn, right, to dedicate my time and my effort and. And help these young adults out, I'm really going to do it right because I know how important it is for them. So really great experiences overall. Very good.
Cool. So you went from there.
After that, I continued in the industry and I worked. And now I did a lot of, let's say, manufacturing work. Obviously, I was working at a car plant. And I worked at one of my terms. I actually went to Germany as a student. We had an exchange program from the U.S. to Germany, but the university had a lot of Germans that came to the U.S. To GMI, but we didn't have so many Americans that went to Germany because, of course, you know, engineering, mechanical engineering in German for an American, it was going to be very difficult. So at some point, my university said, okay, we need to have this program in English so that, you know, we also have some students because if not, this is not a proper exchange program. So I was actually part of the first group of students that went to Germany for 3 months to learn at the Fachhochschule, to learn engineering. And it was in English and it was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. And I also stayed for another 3 months in Opel in the headquarters, which is in a town called Rüsselsheim. In Germany, and I was working in the R&D team because I was obviously used to the manufacturing part, but this was very different and I wanted to do something different. There aren't many R&D facilities in Spain. We have a lot of manufacturing plants, actually. The automotive industry is very big in Spain, but not in R&D. So actually, when I finished my university and I finished my work with Opel, of course, you know, I had the possibility to continue to work in Opel, but mm-hmm. I thought, well, I want to do something different. And I joined SEAT, which is part of Volkswagen, which actually is the only car company that has an R&D facility in Spain. So I joined their R&D team. I joined a trainee program as well, where I did several rotations, and I spent some time in Germany again working for Audi. And then I worked in a department that was really interesting that was called PKO, Product Costing Optimization, which is basically optimizing the cost of the product, of the car, but also the weight. So we had a team of engineers whose only purpose was to reduce the cost of the car and to reduce the weight of the car, which is, of course, very much related to cost.
Interesting. So maybe I'm taking a leap too far, but it seems like this is kind of a little bit linked with carbon footprint in a way. You're looking at the carbon cost, you're looking at the weight cost versus the carbon cost. It certainly is.
And if you think that, you know, if you relate it to obvious things like, you know, miles per gallon and fuel consumption, obviously your weight is going to make a major difference in the performance of your car, right? So very much so. Yeah, it was all around, you know, doing the same thing, but in a better way, doing more with less. No? And to me, sustainability is all about that as well.
Very good. So how did you go from the automobile industry into reusable transport, to returnable transport items, RTIs?
That's a great question. I studied an MBA. So after my time at SEAT, I studied an MBA in Barcelona at TSE. So I quit my job and I did a full-time MBA for 2 years. Wow. And I loved it. I really enjoyed it. Actually, it was a fantastic experience from a personal point of view, but I also learned a lot. As an engineer, there are so many topics that you don't cover in school. So it was very complementary to my background, let's say, to my studies. And when you're in the MBA on the second year, you have companies come in and present, and they're doing recruiting, of course, and you have opportunities to get to know new companies, new people, et cetera. No? And it's really, really great, actually. And one day I was working at a room with a friend of mine, and he said, oh, there's a company coming this afternoon, which is called CHEP. And I, of course, I had no idea who CHEP were. And I said, CHEP, what do they do? And my friend says, they do pallets. And I said, wow, that sounds boring. And he said, no, actually, it's quite an interesting company. You know, they have this very sophisticated network that they use for pallets, etc. I'm like, pallets? You mean the wooden things? Yeah, pallets. Of course, you know, imagine me coming from an automotive background as an engineer.
It's like the Stone Age.
So I ended up going, no, come along. So I ended up going. And look, I'm in general, you know, I'm really curious about things, and I love learning, and I love, you know, learning about new stuff. So I thought, well, yeah, let's learn about what they do. So I attended the presentation. It was actually the president of Europe at the time that came over and made the presentation. And then we had like a little cocktail, you know, with students to have a drink. And I remember at that time, of course, I found it interesting. And at that time I was thinking, you know, if I ever work here, I don't see myself like, at a cocktail talking about pallets. I mean, come on, how terrible can this be, right? And then, of course, I actually worked for CHEP and Brambles for 17 years. So imagine, who would have said?
And so what is it that makes it more interesting than you would think?
That's really it. Because, of course, when you say a pallet, you know, it doesn't sound exciting. I think what's exciting about this industry is everything that is behind the pallet, right? All the stuff that you don't see, and how complex it is, really, and the let's say the scale of the operation of the solution. It's obviously a very smart solution, but the scale of everything that goes up in the everything that happens in the background in order for this to actually work, let's say, to make it happen. And to be honest, they had a really interesting program as well. I joined the Brambles Leadership Program, which was a 3-year rotational program again. So I spent 1 year in Germany, 1 year in London, and then I came back to Madrid. Actually, I had been out of Madrid for many years, mm-hmm. and I came back to Madrid to work.
And you're in Madrid now, are you? That's where you're
I'm
based.
In Madrid now. Yep. So after London, I came to Madrid, and now I continue to be based in Madrid. So it was the program already made it interesting as well for me, again, from my background and spending time abroad, etc. I was always interested in working in let's say international backgrounds, you know, with people from other cultures, working abroad as well. And I didn't really see myself working for, you know, a Spanish business located in Spain with only like a local business. I always had, you know, maybe maybe in my unconscious, actually, working for an international business with an international background, et cetera, which was more of what I was used to, actually.
So I saw one of the things that you focused on was Brexit, right? That was one of your responsibilities. Yeah. So has Brexit, you know, how is the actuality, the reality compared to what you were kind of preparing for?
Wow, Brexit. That's an interesting one. So look, I'll give you the reason why I did Brexit, actually. So I was already working in sustainability at Brambles, and Brexit was something that obviously people knew about. Of course, nobody knew whether it was still going to happen or not, right? Mm-hmm. The referendum had already taken place, but there was so much debate around the implications and whether it was going to be a hard Brexit or not, mm-hmm. all the story, of course. And what happened at Brambles was that, you know, there were different people in different departments sort of looking at Brexit and how it would affect them, but probably not in a very serious manner, because nobody really knew what was going to happen. And, you know, let's say from the first identification, we thought, well, it's not going to be that bad, let's say. No, it doesn't really affect us so much. But as things started to develop, then, of course, you know, we started to look into Brexit in a bit more depth. We realized, well, maybe it actually does. So one of the decisions that was made was, okay, we need like a Brexit project manager. We need somebody in the company that is coordinating all of the efforts, that understands what is happening, and of course, how is this going to affect us, so that we can put a mitigation plan in place. And that, of course, you know, who has the profile for that? Well, it's very difficult, right? I mean, there isn't just one single profile to do that. I mean, other than somebody that had done, you know, the year 2000 project back in 98, 99, which was sort of similar, no? A big disruption coming in, obviously from a technology point of view, was very different. But here it was, yeah, something sort of unknown. It could be a potential big disruption. And one of my mentors at Brambles asked me, you know, we were thinking about this, we were debating this in the leadership team, and we thought, you know, I thought maybe you would be a good candidate for that. And I thought to myself, you know, why me? I'm not British. That's the first thing I thought. So I don't know anything about Brexit. And therefore, you know, why would you want a Spaniard, you know, looking after Brexit as a company? And the answer to my question was precisely because you're Spanish. So we want somebody that is completely outside of this whole, let's say, political debate, because of course you need to understand that Brexit was something very, very controversial, as you know. Of course, you know, let's say, in day-to-day life of people in the UK and people in Europe in general, but also in day-to-day life at work, right? So you had different people with different opinions. So it could get a bit, let's say, sort of personal. So they thought, actually, having somebody that has nothing to do with this is probably a good idea. So for me, it was a bit tough because I thought, well, you know, I think I need to learn. I mean, I knew a little bit, of course, but I think I need to learn a lot more about Brexit. So I ended up, you know, reading the Financial Times and listening to BBC and watching, you know, UK TV basically every day as part of my job, actually, which made it really interesting. I actually learned a lot. I of course, I had been with the business for already, 14, 15 years. So I knew the business very well. But, you know, this opened me a lot of different things about the business. I was already very much into sustainability as well. So therefore, you know, areas like finance or areas like, I don't know, things like, of course, customs, you know, which was very important for us. I learned a lot in that as well. And of course, very soon we realized that Brexit was a big deal for us as well, just as it was for many companies. So you asked me, you know, how did it turn out at the end versus what was expected, let's say. Again, you know, if you were asked me at the beginning of my assignment, I would say, well, Brexit is not going to be that bad. Then if you asked me at the middle of my assignment, we were like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Because with pallets, I mean, there was one big deal with pallets, and maybe you learned about this, which was around phytosanitation conditions. Mm-hmm. And basically, you know, there is an international rule called ISPM 15 that is set up by FAO, by the Food and Agriculture Organization of UN, that determined that every piece of timber that crosses international borders needs to be sanitized, needs to be phytosanitized to kill bacteria, basically. And this is to protect the forest. So there was a bacteria called nematode that would basically destroy a full forest many years ago. And there's still cases in some places, isolated cases. But in any case, that meant that pallets, you know, that would travel the world, let's say, would need to be treated, heat treated. So basically you put them in a kiln, you heat treat them for hours, and then that kills, you know, all of the living animals in the pallet and therefore in the wood. And therefore, you know, the cross contamination possibility is gone. No? Now,
but what if the pallet has got something on it? Obviously, you can't do that.
When you manufacture the pallet, you just need to do it once.
Oh, I see.
When you manufacture the pallet. Okay. Yeah, it's with fresh timber when you manufacture. And then, I mean, the reason why Brexit affected this was that the European Union, when this was put in place, set up a rule that movements of pallets within the European Union did not need phytosanitation, did not need this treatment, because all of the countries were already doing what they had to do to protect the forest, right? And of course, this included the UK. So when the UK decided to leave the European Union, that meant that this rule did no longer apply, or this exemption did no longer apply. So therefore, all of the pallets crossing the UK back and forth every year would need to be heat treated. Now, when you have a company like Brambles that owns over 300 million pallets in circulation, and of course you cannot distinguish one from the other, all of a sudden you realize, well, does this mean that I need to heat treat my full pool, my whole pool, so that I am complying with the legislation, with the law, let's say. So again, a really big deal. Now, there was only one small advantage, which is that, of course, part of the key to reusable packaging is standardization. So there is a size and a sort of a weight and a design, a standard design of a pallet that is called the Euro pallet. So it's used in Europe mainly, and the dimensions are 800 by 1200. And in the UK, there is another size of pallet that we call the UK pallet or the international pallet, which is 100 by 1200. And this was actually an advantage because most of the flows to the UK were done on this specific format. So, you know, if worse came to show to say, okay, we need to heat treat all of our pool, well, at least, you know, we knew that it would have to be only, or the majority of the pallets would be of that format and not the rest as well.
So the British non-standard, we're going to do it our way, actually helped in this. So so is the net that it was like not super disruptive for Brambles business?
It was very disruptive in terms of getting ready for it, to be honest. I mean, at the end, things worked out quite well. But I mean, again, no challenges like this, challenges around costumes, challenges around GDPR. I mean, there were so many issues, as I mentioned, that just getting ready for it was a big deal. It's a big deal.
Huge,
big project.
Huge deal.
It basically affected every single part of the organization.
And I know you're not an economist, but what's your view on the impact of this on Europe's economy? And what's your view on the impact on the UK economy? And I realize this is like a huge subject. So just kind of your headline view of this. I'm really interested.
Look, I continue to read about that. And basically, of course, when I this is, of course, my personal opinion, but when I was going through all of this, and I met, you know, a lot of employees, colleagues of mine that were pro-Brexit, actually, no, and I was trying to also understand it. But to me, you know, looking at, you know, all of the implications for us as a business, but in general to the economy, of course, you know, it didn't make much sense looking at it from the outside. And I continue to read and I see that, you know, the UK economy already at the time was suffering from this and, you know, same as the European, but in a more accelerated way. And I think that's the situation now as well, you know, that basically the growth that is taking place in the UK is not as it would have been if it wasn't for Brexit. So unfortunately, I think it has affected them. Will it continue to affect them for a long time? I don't know. I think that's what nobody really knows. But okay. So far, I think it definitely has.
Well, this has been fascinating. And we could talk some more about it. I know that we haven't gone right up to the final piece of the story, which is you move from Brambles to IFCO. So maybe we should just say a few words on that and then we'll get to the really fun bit, which is your music choice. But
Sure. So, I mean, for some people that might not know, IFCO was actually part of the Brambles group for almost 10 years. So I already knew IFCO from before. But Brambles decided to divest IFCO in 2018. And basically, no, sorry, 2019. And they sold the business, no? And IFCO is a company that does reusable packaging, specifically for fresh produce. By reusing plastic crates, no? So very similar business to what CHEP is doing with pallets, let's say, but of course in a more niche market, which is the fruit and veg, let's say primary packaging in most cases. So when Brambles sold IFCO, to me it was a sad decision, let's say, because of work. I was already working in sustainability. Of course, there were, you know, all of the great things around reusable packaging applied to IFCO as well. And I thought, well, it's a great business unit. It's very complementary to what we're doing. It's part of our story. We're already working in things like plastic. Of course, we were working on things like water conservation, etc. And I thought, well, you know, this is a business decision. Of course, I respected it, but it was sort of sad, let's say. So then Mike Pooley, my current boss, joined IFCO a year after it was sold as CEO. And then a year after that, he actually called me and said, well, he sent me a text and he said, how are you doing, Inigo? You know, we need to catch up soon. And of course, you know, the moment I saw that, I knew what was coming, right? And it's funny because it never crossed my mind before. I don't know why, you know, when we sold the business or later on, it never crossed my mind that, oh, you know, what's going to happen with sustainability at IFCO? I mean, I thought about it, of course, but for some reason, I never saw myself going to IFCO, actually. Of course, the moment I saw that text, I knew what was the question I was going to get, no? So, of course, you know, are you interested? And to be honest, the first thing I thought was, wow, you know, I was sort of put back because my reflection was, I'm going to have to make a tough decision. That was the first thing that crossed my mind because I was really happy at Brambles. I had been there for many years. I had done many different roles, but in the last years I was working in sustainability. We had a fantastic program. I was, you know, with lots of course, room for development as well. And therefore, I really had no reason to leave, right? But on the other hand, I thought, well, maybe an opportunity comes that I cannot say no to, and then I need to think about doing something else. And that's exactly what happened, of course. So this was a fantastic opportunity for me to lead an ESG function, a sustainability program at the company, and to, you know, basically shape it in the way that I wanted and to take it to the next level. So really, really excited and really actually, you know, let's say thankful for given the opportunity to do something like that.
And how big are the relative sustainability teams in those two organizations? And maybe you can contrast the size of the companies. I'm just trying to get a metric in my head, you know.
Look, when I mean, my team is actually quite small. I mean, the approach is very similar. Of course, you know, basically, I joined the sustainability team at CHEP and Brambles fairly early on, let's say. So my boss was the head of sustainability who had just started the function, let's say. So I joined quite early on and therefore, you know, influence in shaping the approach to sustainability, of course, the objectives, the targets, the program, etc. Again, working with my manager. And therefore, you know, obviously, the approach I have taken is very similar. So, because they are very similar companies as well, no? In terms of what we do as a business and with sustainability, of course, I think what really matters is that you shape a program that is in line with what you do as a business, right? So, of course, there are certain elements that everybody has to look at, all companies need to look at. But look, you know, a car manufacturer, for example, is very different to what we do. So, it wouldn't make any sense to have, you know, a standard program. There isn't like a one size fits all. So, again, both companies are very similar in what we do with, again, differences in the product, maybe in the regions. But in any case, there are a lot of similarities. So the way that I see my team now and what we're doing is a bit like what Brambles was doing a few years ago. Because, of course, in this case, IFCO is a much smaller company and they have already gone through that journey, probably that we are going through now at IFCO. So The main aspect that is similar and that is very important is that, I mean, there's many ways to set up a program, a sustainability program, ESG program, and function. But I tend to see it in two different, mainly two different ways. One is, you know, having, let's say, a team that is part of the business, and you have a dedicated function with a group of experts that are touching each of the different elements of the program and develop initiatives, develop programs, collaborations, etc. So everything is centralized with a big ESG team that is the owner of the program. And then the other option is to integrate the program within the business, right? Which is what we have done at IFCO, which is we have a very small team that sets the direction, sets the ambition, let's say, and then collaborates with the business, who is actually the different departments who are the ones that need to drive the program, that need to put in place the initiatives, that need to actually, again, not do the same as they were doing before, but in a better way. And I think this way works better because, first of all, they have the expertise and they have the knowledge. And this is, again, you know, sustainability in the majority of things that we manage, it's the day-to-day of our business, right? So it's transport, it's raw materials, it's, of course, washing and cleaning. All of that is what we do in our day-to-day. It's just looking at it from a different lens, let's say. So, again, now answering your question, very similar, but of course, you know, Brambles is a much bigger company and their program is a bit more developed as well. So they have a slightly bigger, structure. But one thing that is similar as well is that, again, it's very much integrated into the business and it's very much integrated into the strategy as well, which I think is really important.
All right. Well, so on to my last question, which is three songs. What three songs would you choose as your favorite songs and why?
Yeah, I was. I love music and I love all sorts of music. But I was thinking, okay, which ones would I choose? And it was so difficult, right? Of course. So the first one I would say is Thunder Road from Bruce Springsteen. And the reason for that is that, well, I love this song, but it's also about the artist. I mean, for me, it's more than the song, it's about the artist and what they have meant to me. So I am a brother of four. We are five siblings in my family. I'm the youngest of five. And I used to share a room with one of my brothers. And he loved Bruce Springsteen when we were growing up. So, of course, you can imagine you share a room and he's the older. So that means that I need to listen to whatever he likes to listen and you end up liking it. So I love Bruce Springsteen. I'm a big fan and Thunder Road is a fantastic song. So that would be my first choice. My second choice is another great band that I love, which is Dire Straits. And they have a song called Tunnel of Love. Yes. And Dire Straits was a song that Dire Straits was a band that I loved growing up, you know, with my friends. And it was a band that I, you know, when I grew up, they were not doing concerts anymore. You know, they had done concerts up until the 90s, let's say, and they stopped that. And I would have always loved to go to a concert of Dire Straits. And you know, when eventually I ended up going to a concert of Dire Straits and I loved it. I could have many, many songs from Dire Straits, but this is one that I really like. So one that is close to my friends as well. And then the last one, a bit different, a song from Louis Armstrong, and here it's about the artist as well. So I would say, you know, What a Wonderful World. Two main reasons. First of all, because my dad is a huge fan of jazz, and when we were young, we would travel, you know, for the weekend, we would go skiing or we would go spend the weekend somewhere by car, of course, and we all had a time in the car to play our own music. And of course, my dad had the longest time of all of us. And he would always play jazz music. So basically, you know, I've grown up listening to jazz music. He had, you know, hundreds of records of jazz. And I hated it because it reminded me, you know, in the car, you know, the music, of course, I wanted to listen to the Smurfs or whatever it was at the time. And he, you know, for him, it was all jazz. So I hated it because it reminded me of me getting sick in the car, etc. But of course, you know, then you grow up and you learn to appreciate these things. And now I love jazz. And of course, it reminds me of my dad. And, you know, A Wonderful World is a fantastic, positive song. And I'm a very positive person as well. So there's a link to the, let's say, lyrics of the song as well.
Those are wonderful choices. I really appreciate the thinking behind them as well. So Inigo, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
Pleasure.
So, hope you enjoyed that conversation. Really fascinating career. Really nice guy. Real pleasure to have on the show. If you have been, thanks very much for listening. Thanks very much for watching. And I look forward to seeing you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.